for inviting me. It's really nice to be here. I'm going to read by team because hopefully that'll be more interesting and hold your attention. And also, I'm going to read a mixture as well from my book Encounter, which is for sale, and if you like it. Already sold one copy, thanks Tom. And new work. And weirdly, the theme is kind of divided neatly between the book and my new work. So apparently, I'm finished writing about family, writing, and love and sex. And now, when I write about it being inside stuff, I'm my pregnant sister June. So I don't know what to make of that. Maybe you can have a think about that while I'm reading. So the first theme I'm going to read on is writing, which is something I suppose me and Tina and the group we read with started looking at our poems about writing, and I didn't realise I had any, but everyone writes about writing, I suppose, and it's an interesting thing to think about. So the first one is called Ache, and it's about an experience I had in an Edinburgh graveyard very early in the morning, and it's just this experience that's been a catalyst for me to write. The third and fourth child born to one of the Archibald Aitkins in St. Cuthbert's graveyard is a girl, Elizabeth. She died an infant twice. She comes to hunt for crumbs dangerously early, sliding her morning dry fingers into the damp hollows of her stone skulls, sneaking around the gold-basted drunks like sphinxes the fierce green sun couldn't wake. The high church crunching down on her hip, warm and promising as a lover. The second time, she lasted 23 months. The rutted tree trunks are full of fertilizing whispers under her palm. Strong peepers wood. As office workers begin to pass through at speed along indented lines, its touch closes a circuit and returns to face and fingers the wet life all this sleep takes away. I've written a lot of poems about those girls that I saw in the headstone. This is another one from that series. It's called The Blitz Machine. I am Elizabeth. I turn slowly over in my grinding grave till my outer arm brushes myself. I turn till I kiss myself, and our faces wear away on each other. How have you crept over my mound again with your dangerous joy, coming between words into my mouth and packing it? I am called Elizabeth, and she is Elizabeth called me. The click of my sockets wakes me when one of us can't sleep. How did you find this hole and squeeze in so tightly on me that my leg must lie between yours, that your breasts must lie between mine, that I inhale your exhale? I may be Elizabeth. We might both be. If she comes and I am still here, we will have to take turns. I will turn as you turn, so gently the earth will hardly move. Our named letters will slant a degree. I will force my space into your spaces. I am worth Elizabeth, and she is deserving. I will mix the humming mud around us with her, with your monophonic blood. How did you know me after I had peeled off all of you and made this beautiful tomb from it? How can you slip back into yourself as if nothing had happened? Now I promise that my face will take your face off. I promise that my skin and flesh will rub your body raw. I promise that my naked skull will crumble your bones to dust. Our central cords will eventually touch, and we will meet again. And the third poem in this kind of theme of writing is called St. James. I've done the last 6 days at the Camino de Santiago a few times with my father, and again found it an amazing catalyst and trying to grasp the idea of ancient stories and myths and the mix of voices and how the same story can be told by several people. There's a poem within a poem in this. I don't know how to read so that comes across, so I'm telling you. The last section of the Camino is the simplest, but we toiled, battered with hard heat and human weakness, to get to Compostela, the field of stars. And as we marched, I told you the story of Santiago and that shining field where his body came on the stone boat, home to beloved Spain. How you smiled that small smile, my love, my lord, other names, when we struggled up the beautiful marble steps and together threw our sweat-soaked, sun-soaked, shaking arms around his golden mantle and wet his shoulders with slavish, salty lips at last. On our return home, you ploughed me into the ground as fast as you could, and it became a memory, a wild, bright kaleidoscope. And in the incredible spiral of metal and stone, I died. You screamed you were sorry several times, that you couldn't get out, and I twisted and fought away from you, from your heavy, unconscious embrace. How I gathered and counted each delicate heartbeat, my love, my lord, other names. How I wiped your aching brow and bathed your feet, how I read and wrote, calculated and wept over your brittle body before. My obsessive notes mock me. You tried to carry me home, and I believe that you meant to. Feet and hands, bob man brown, I follow the road of that flashing day. The lonely Irish road you left me beside. Freed, I roll over and over in the ecstatic air past the signs that point the way to Tir Reisin, which I say means country of stars. Underneath the choked sky, the way, a shocking line raised from the marsh, stretches tightrope straight to the horizon. Where all roads meet, I will try another this time. You will stay inert in your strange stone shell. You worried the most about the end, the way it might come at any time, until on the way home you seemed to sleep at last with a page in your lap, as the twinkling lights of this country danced into my blue vision and that deep landing sound came. Your magical prayer, your get-out-of-jail-free card, your poem. Not in the falling, but in the waiting is the real strain. Wind plunges up to enormous heights, almost purple in its haste, entering through both ears, causing a crushing compression, becoming sing-song epilepsy. This freeze haze instant I awake. Dissension friction, broad unstoppable screams, no hole inhale, the clear rare air here, the blast of the four wastes into our systems. My lungs destroy and replace my lungs, I crush each fractal piece, they reform in the split second vacuum they leave. I feel you so near me, your body, your bones, finally mine. What bliss, we cannot separate, you wrote. Time stops, astounded, and rewinds. How I heaved your body onto that stone both then, my love, my lord, other names. And you returned that way to your people. I bent my back under the rock until I became as small, as crushed together as an atom. It constructed 1,000 silver stars above you, and 1,000 gigantic adamantine angels to support your crypt. I hunched patiently underneath, as if still waiting for the voyage to begin. How could you have arrived at the Spanish coast without me? Some think I crouch there now, though my work is done. In the cramped, dark space beneath the stone shape they point to on pattern day. Some think you are not a man, but a golden bell that I carried here. My lord, I think it is because the sound they remember of you speaking has the clarity of a ring. I knew they would canonize you when I stayed here after the journey and died, but I thought they would leave me separate. To be like this, all bones and scraps fluttered around and inside you in this reliquary, is intolerable. The next theme I'm going to read about is family, as I said. And I think family maybe is a kind of emotive theme for poets in general. I've had to explain exhaustively to my parents that when I use the word mother or father in my poems, it's not necessarily about them. It's actually the archetypal image of mother. You'd be banging your head off the wall, they don't believe me. And a lot of these are about my father. Giving the lie, as I just said. About, and it's not so much, it's about the relationship a daughter has with her father, which I think is a really complex thing and so hard to get your head around. So this one's called Going. He taught us how to go, my father. In prickly, stubbly fields, we hoisted up our matching white sundresses, my angelic little sister and I. Her fat legs bent as if they had no bones. Even she, hardly able to walk, grasped exactly how to do it. As I squatted, I watched how exquisitely she kept her tiny knickers held away. And the dark brown tower that he was to me then kept watch over us, like a small boy with a precious crop of mushrooms. And this now is a more controversial father poem that unfortunately I've read aloud on RTE Radio 1 and also in other public venues, and my poor father, etc. It's called Castration. But it's a loving poem. I remember when I realised I wasn't a man. I stood in front of my father, aged 3. His pink penis hung squat along his fluffy thighs, commanding affection like a puppy. I thought it and him sweetly unfortunate. What are you made of? I asked him with as many words as I knew, but he had not enough words to answer. It's funny the way the microphone pops on all the pink penis and so on there. extra emphasis on the words. I'm going to read the title poem from the book. It's called Encounter. I suppose the next two poems are kind of about, you know, family history in a small town, the idea of generation and stories and secrets. You know, fascinating to me. My father used to give us soft old fruits. They smelled like sour feet. The thing in the field across the road found them when we tried to throw them away and turned its invisible face towards us for days. My mother used to sit and cry in the parlour,
the tears veining her beige calves. The madwoman who walked to mass past the house paused, implacable, in the gap between the gateposts for longer and longer intervals. In the church, specific lights went out during the consecration. The two sisters with the same name shifted uneasily in the graveyard, knocking their one headstone sideways. In the town, everyone always whispered, so that a sour old breeze fingered everything. The madwoman coming home after mass never broke her pace while she felt it, or lifted her eyes. Now there is always creaking outside at night. An invisible face turns slowly to follow something, and footsteps outside at night that grow louder and louder until both stop. In the silence of the encounter, my children grow calm and fall asleep. Similar poem, The Succession. I support my mother in the aisle. Here we are, more naked in our good coats than if we had no skin. Simple mosaic tiles pass under our feet. Simple candles peter light on the altar before us. Simple villagers squat in the benches around us. Electric globes with cobwebs grown heavy from decades of dustlessness, swinging from the nave on black copper chains, pass over our heads. I support my mother in the aisle. Here we are, more naked in our good coats than if we had no skin. Rites here are simple as sacrifice and just as bloody. She, unable to contain herself, makes grief noises like wind into my neck. It is like standing in a waterfall, and the failure is her weapon, for in a moment. I support my mother in the aisle. Here we are, more naked in our good coats than if we had no skin. And the failure is her weapon, for in a moment it can become fury. They are the same. And she has, in our shambling embrace, the power to delicately devour each curious stare. I support my mother in the aisle. Here we are, more naked in our good coats than if we had no skin. Weeping crashes into us. We are as lunatic as the sea, but as calm, as the transepts approach. Bronze light falls on the crucifix of the queen, and the pressing mourners fall back to either side. I support my mother in the aisle. Here we are, more naked in our good coats than if we had no skin. Time circles our stooped bodies and swoops in to deafen us. Time roars around us and sweeps grass across ploughed fields and twists hair grey under coloured scarves. Complicated villages continue to unfurl their mud-brown sagas. I support my mother in the aisle. Here we are, more naked in our good coats than if we had no skin. Feeling all that went before quietly leave us. For once she held that status in their society. Whole parishes waited outside the church doors to look at the old king, or through him. And now onto the amazing theme of love and sex. I used to introduce this theme a lot when we read together, and myself and Tina and Shirley and Jane, Catch the Moon, check us out. And it's been funny because I often introduce the theme of love by saying it's ironic that I'm introducing it because I've been so recently the survivor of, you know, ridiculous heartbreak. But I learned from that and from being forced to introduce it and think about it that my love is something that it exists independently of any object or person. And that was a good thing to learn, I think. And then from reading with Jen, I had a kind of conversation on stage where I realised that while some people might write consistently pessimistic poems about love and already write, I seem to write consistently optimistically, or at least in a fashion of believing that I am in love and be wrong, in fact. So I don't know whether it's better to be pessimistic and right or optimistic and wrong, but that's the way I am. I'm going to start with reading my five-word poem, if that's okay. But it's kind of on the same theme. It's called Picking Up the Pieces. The silence of inside an empty green bottle used in the morning. Map of tobacco ash flashed like tea leaves along the trunk. My swollen eyes refocus in the swollen silence of its blown rotundity. Heineken, the crusty palate of my underage misdeeds. This is called Plague. Someone I was with once said to me, why aren't you writing poems about me? And I said, sure, I wrote this about you. And he said, the plague? Generally positive, though. A stray arrow got in and pierced the slate-grey skin of St. Sebastian. Now he wonders with desperate eyes how to get out of his display case. Your fingers interlace mine loosely, damp and obscene in the cool cathedral. Sebastian, it isn't the same as only having your own thoughts to contend with. It isn't the same as being entirely contained by that slate-grey coolness. and now a series of short poems about unfortunate sexual encounters. Not really optimistic until I have to say. Hair trigger. Right at 8, he fell without warning into cold, brutish sleep, and I was trapped and thoughtful under his suddenly bestial body. A half erection paused against me. His eyelids leaped with instant dreams an inch away from my face. His great arm snapped shut across my neck like a falling pillar. And I, bare-breasted, one foot hanging out of bed, kept perfectly still. This one called Measles. His watch sits on the table, rash, itchy. My pillowcase and sheets are inside out, the sour milk smell of our union folded away. I will wrap myself in them as if I had the measles and soon off tomorrow. This one's called Jaded. Spent on his golden back, he remarked that I sucked the life out of him. My tongue in the mornings was numb and swollen. I suckled it from his womb, I throve, I glowed. He weakened, of course. I should have pulled back. And now we both sicken. My willing mark and I, least successful as succubi. And this one's called Rick. This is the last of them. Okay, unfortunately. I put your finger into my mouth, and with my tongue and teeth took off your silver ring. I sucked the metallic tang of it away, swallowing until it tasted like me. I kept it there forever against my cheek. It clicks and rattles like diamonds when I speak. Now this one I wrote because we were reading about spring, but it didn't turn out to be about spring. Or St. Bridget. My husband yourself went to visit St. Bridget's shrine in Louth, your home place. I laughed at the snake at the feet of St. Patrick that looked like a turd. The people who knelt to respectfully place their heads in the wall's hole, looking for relief from head pain of all kinds, and drove you away. Both of us filled with head pain of all kinds. That woman, who turned baking into a stone for God or something I learned in school, could probably have told me something was amiss. The last poem in the sequence is another new poem. That's a new poem I just wrote in the book for Pete. It's called Plums. They give me plums, but I leave them aside. I leave them alone until they fill and darken and swell a sweetness this side of wrong, and then I accept them one by slithering one into my mouth, licking the liquid flesh from the bones, collecting stones. Yeah, to go on to another theme, give you all release here. I'm working on a long sequence called Inside, as Emmy has said. It started out, I don't know how it started, but I've become obsessed with the human heart, not just the heart, the body being inside, and that, I suppose it started when I asked my father how it felt to be a man. I was obsessed with the idea of what it feels like to be inside somebody, and it went from there into kind of study of the human heart, not the kind of romantic heart that people talk about, but the grotesque, pulsating thing that we have in us. So I'll just read a series of poems from that. The first one called Imaginatively Enough Inside. When I was a child, a strange man came to tune our piano. It was the first time that I thought about climbing inside. He showed me, with his stranger's voice and ways, how the neat hammers hung tensed in tight arrays, ready at his easy bidding to leap to the sounding strings, to make the music appear to come from the keys. When the lid was closed and the man was gone, they reverted to mocking cacophony. The longing began and grew to touch in the dark of the wooden guts the secret harp that I knew was hidden there, to tangle the careful strings around my fingers and ankles and throat, to try to show, to plead, that I was as much a slave as he. And the next one I'm going to read is called Inside 2. Sorry about that. There's 5 of them. Some of the others aren't called Inside. I take you in my arms, still cold from the hold, and finger your contents to see if the various glistening eggs inside are intact, my tagged, my carouseled womb. I set you on my body and allow the marks you have made to rekindle their blazing pain. You are so familiar that I weep when it starts to fade. You will squat on my hard floor at home until you have earned the grand unpacking. I don't care if I never discover what treasure I thought half-hearted to bring. I practiced incredibly briefly as a medical doctor, for 18 months in fact, before leaving. And then erased all of that, all of those memories, and they've only really come back this year, and I started writing about that time. So this poem is, about that time, and it's really disgusting and hard, and you know, if people are squeamish, you don't have to listen to it. But I can see why I forgot it, basically. called Burn Baby. My first day of theatre, they wheeled in a burn baby. All black and pink blotches, all shrill piglet moans, all stiff swollen limbs. Then they used a machine called the dermatome to scrape its remaining skin off, and they clumsily wrapped it around its fingers, its torso, its sooty cheekbones. Some of the nurses cried, but I, who had not even seen ingrown toenail surgery, hadn't the measure of my reactions yet. A neighbour phoned. Hello, he said. Are you being a good girl? I heard that you saw a burned baby. Excuse me, I said, but these tendrils of skin unpeeling limply around my ears are making it hard to hear you. So no, I suppose. Tight black scrap. By now you have been patched and stitched so many times you're a writhing map. A Van Gogh child who screams in the bath, who looks in the mirror and laughs. I heard you saw a burned baby, a neighbour said to me that day. Yes, I was there, I saw you. Can't be forgiven. This next one, some people are familiar with, it's called Probable Misuse of Shamanism. how to introduce this? It's written in the style of the ancient bards who were, you know, considered almost nobility in Ireland. If you slice them, they wrote a curse poem for you, and that curse came true. I enjoy that idea, I tried to practice it myself. So that's where this poem came from. I recently been informed that unless the person who the curse is for hears the curse, it's not going to work, so I have to figure that out. That's obviously where I went wrong. Imagine a hole in the ground, the book says. But this time I find myself clambering through your great vein, or inferior vena cava, as other quite different books call it. Surrounded by black stagnant blood and the beat of the drum, if I work hard enough, I will come to the writhing bowl of your right atrium, and then the possibilities are endless. I can sit quite still, with a choking gutful of irony wine, and allow my foreignness to disrupt the smooth flow, turbulent that is called, through the mitral valve, so the little clots form and are shot around and out to your lungs. An exercise in anticipation for me, the knowing wait for the sharp pain, the breathless death. I can kick and claw at the great central wall to make a small hole, and squeeze through to the business side. From there, I will have no choice but to be shunted straight to your brain, whence the dullness will spread, and the FAST protocol from the stroke guard will come into play. Then, like that old film, I will have to exit through the nearest opening, your roomy eye probably, before I run out of tea for time. I can simply tear it apart, though this will be most difficult, it feels the most satisfying. Begin with cutting the beautiful strings, then rip off the valve lips like so many yogurt lids. Finally work my hands bloody, like crying in a swimming pool, taking the central divide asunder. Yes, how satisfying to gut it like that, so nothing can hide. Sometimes I feel so much strength that I think I could reach in under your straining ribcage with my bare hands and pluck the grotesque, pulsating thing out like a weed. But they'd eat independently, and I can't imagine not flinging it away in disgust, not screaming and stamping like a child of an eel, not cowering in a corner while the pathetic lump convulses at last. The book says to make sure and come out before the drumbeat stops. I'm not sure what happens otherwise. Now to finish off the Inside series, Inside 4, which is subtitled Of Procedures. My father's heart upset me, and I cried until they said they would fix it. 4 hours they had him on the table, sedated. He was so proud afterwards. I, who had insisted, was terrified that he would die. So many times I explained to him, and he to me, and the doctor to us, what would happen. A small cut made in the groin, the stiff line fed in, the patiently poking progress of it all the way intimately up through the dead centre of him to the ventricle, glowing blue on the screen. Switch thrown, the electric flash, and then we all explained to each other, the rebellious part of his heart that beat out of time burned off forever. My father's barbecued heart sits squarely at home at the kitchen table since, beating exactly once per second. It could be, for you and me I mean, a kind of abortion, the coat hanger stiff line poking up through the dead, dead centre of you to dismember the strangling child that sits in the heart. To turn it back with the flick of that blue-white switch to ridiculous blood and its unwelcomed kicks to the calm, rudimentary thud of what they call sinus rhythm. Sinus, of course, in this case, meaning hole. And then my final theme, which is that, in fact, of my pregnant sister, Jim, who'd be mortified if she knew I had voted the whole theme. She doesn't like me. But it's our first nephew. She's had him. He exists now. And, you know, I've never been so close to a pregnant person. It makes you think a lot, and it puts a lot of stuff into perspective, I think. So I'm just going to read some poems about that. I read one of these as well on RT, and I rang June and said, can I read this poem? I keep saying you're beautiful. I say you're beautiful three times, and she's like, you have to. This is called Drinking Comfort. Today I took out the lemon yellow wool, doubling it extremely soft, and cast on 77 stitches. As I worked, knuckles and shoulders seizing, I thought of my sister at home in her beautiful house with her beautiful husband, hugging her secret pregnancy to herself. As I worked, and the baby soft rose grew insistently, vine-like, out of my hands, I thought of her beautiful body knitting furiously together the tiny knuckles and shoulders of that little one. When I was two or three, the bottle of lemon yellow fabric softener in the kitchen hypnotized me. I knew enough to tell it was bad, but couldn't not drink. When my mother discovered the glistening trail on my mouth, she made me sick. I don't remember the taste, but I long for the blue, the yellow, the pink. Now this one's called The Dresser. They kind of go in the chronology of her pregnancy. But I suppose it was a chronology of thinking for me, following it. My pregnant sister clears out the dresser at home. On the dusty top of it, presents that were instantly forgotten, coats for parties that were only worn once, spiders. On the uppermost shelf, books about happiness in marriage, happiness in children, happiness in love. On the second shelf, books for children, books about management, the Guinness Book of Records, 1988. On the big third shelf, adult nappies, first aid kits, deodorants, antibacterial wipes, plasters. In the closed presses at the bottom, no one knows. She skips the bottom press and uses the antibacterial product to sweep the rest into refuse sacks, working her determined way up. On the dusty top shelf, she finds, sweating, fledged soap rag in hand, a photograph of the dresser from years ago. It is bare and has been newly cleaned. Tomorrow, in another room, our mother will notice the Ina Blyton books that she thought she threw out years ago, and she will arrange them lovingly on the second shelf. Now this one's called Son, which is, I was convinced that June was having a girl, and then when I wrote this, it was S-U-N, but still I was like, and then it was a boy, so either way I'm psychic, I had all my bases covered. In her 34th week of carrying you, your mother went to the sea. As she stood in the car park looking, great waves of lumbering fog rolled in one after the other, obscuring the beautiful bay, the cliffs, the horizon, the water, the ridiculous February sun. But the minute she turned her back to visit the public toilet again, they would be gone, rushing over the waiting fields and dissolving mischievously, and ridiculous February sun would have returned. Yeah, I don't know, something about a baby coming into your kind of sphere of influence makes things seem more positive. It had that effect on me anyway. I wrote this while she was in labour. It's called The Beginning. While you labour, I wander aimlessly around town. The importance of my business there lost. I pick up something called a bath bomb for you, thinking you will need to patch an uneasy truce for your sullen body after this. Thinking of how little a scented bath can matter against the imminent explosion. Thinking of how you are changing into somebody else, into two, one of whom will henceforth be the new master of the old you. I can only write, sheepishly present you with my version of a child, confuse you with my pseudo-maternal pride. I can only write what I write. I can't even cry. And then she had him. So this is the last poem I'm going to read, and so I want to say thanks again to Paul and everyone for having me, and thanks to you all for listening. You're a lovely audience. And yeah, my book is for sale if anyone wants to buy it, but I think about my job, you know. this god Bayes. The day my godchild was born, you left me spread sideways across my pink mattress, blinking and opening and closing my fists, unhinged. The second day when I held him, he had learned to fall against me in bliss, had learned the fat contentment of just being alive. Thank you.